As to the divination, which takes place in sleep and is said to be based on dreams, we cannot lightly either dismiss it with contempt or give it implicit confidence. These were the words of Aristotle, written in 350 BCE and taken very much to heart by a British psychiatrist in the 1960s, when he took on the monumental task of collecting and collating hundreds of premonitions from across the country, with the ultimate goal of not only researching the phenomena, but then also using the data to avert disaster, and perhaps even to save the world. This is Dark Histories, where the facts are worse than fiction. Hello and welcome to Dark Histories, Season 8, Episode 5. I'm your host, Ben. Today, we've got a story that's a little bit more modern than usual. I thought we'd sort of step a little bit past World War II. I don't tend to do that very frequently. I did it once or twice in the past. Did it once actually fairly recently with, was it Jeff, I think? But yeah, I tend to think, you know, if the story is interesting enough, then I will do it. But it does make things interesting for me as well every now and then, because the research changes, I think, once you get sort of this modern. I say this modern, still from the 60s, so 1960s. So it's not exactly, you know, yesterday. But anyway, it's an interesting story. I found it and I just thought, it's too interesting to pass up, despite the fact that it's not, you know, Victorian or earlier. So anyway, I hope you enjoy it. There's not much else to say about it, so we might as well just get started. This episode is called Prophecy, Second Sight, and John Barker's Premonitions Bureau. 5,000 years ago, when an ancient Mesopotamian king fell ill, it was less a matter for the doctors or medicine folk, and far more a matter for the scholars, who spent their time reading omens and scripting out the paths of the future. These court diviners, or baru, would commonly practice extispicy, the process of reading the future in the entrails of a slaughtered sheep, hand-picked from the king's flock for suitability. Every blemish or pimple on a freshly excised liver would be carefully diagnosed under a complicated system of criteria that had been passed down for hundreds of years. Once a diviner was sure that they understood what secrets the organ held, its contents would be disclosed to the king, where his life would be predicted to either wither or flourish. In other situations, the meanings in the liver might cause the outbreak of a war to take place on a coming Tuesday. A lesion or signs of a parasite, however, might well push the launch of the battle back for a week. The success or failure of such things might spell the end not only for an army, but also for the diviner himself. In less gory situations, the same diviners would sprinkle incense onto a burning coal in order to read the smoke that rose into the air for signs, shapes, symbols, and meanings. For the ancient Mesopotamians, divination was a fairly standard part of everyday life. The future was entirely predetermined. The gods had already written it into the fabric of the universe, and it was there for all to read, should one be skilled enough to interpret the signs. Precognition, prophecy, and premonition have all been a staple in civilizations ever since, and all the way up to the governments of modern superpowers. In one way or another, the ability to see the future has stirred anything from deep interest to providing the basis for entire settlements. Following the Mesopotamians, a discovery on the site of an ancient Egyptian workers' village, Deir al-Medina, near the Valley of the Kings, uncovered the ancient Egyptians' propensity to read dreams. The Egyptian Dream Book was an ancient papyrus dating back 3,000 years to the time of Ramesses II. The book attempted to interpret the many different types of dream that one might have had, and then conclude as to whether or not it was a positive or negative portent. If one saw himself drinking a warm beer, then it could well be a sign that bad times were coming his way. Far less vague was the meaning of a dream where one sees himself with their backside on display, which would suggest that they were soon to become an orphan. In Greece, Pythia, the oracle of Delphi and high priestess, would channel the spirit of Apollo, whose temple she resided within, in order to tell the prophecies of future events. It was a talent that gave the position incredible power and made the priestess one of the most prestigious in the classical world. On the seventh day of each month, the priestess's face would be covered with a purple veil, and then, after bathing naked in the Castalian spring as part of a cleansing ritual, a baby goat would be sacrificed. Once its liver had been inspected for favourable signs, its body would be burnt on an altar in the temple's forecourt whilst the priestess gazed into a bowl of spring water. Representatives of city-states and other officials able to afford an agreeable sum to Apollo would then approach the priestess in order to seek her counsel. Later, Aristotle carried out an inquiry into the possibility of prophetic dreams, where he concluded that it is quite conceivable that some dreams may be tokens and causes of future events, though it would be fair to say that he was not entirely convinced of the phenomena. Whether or not the dreams were sent by gods was somewhat by the by, he reasoned, after one considered that the receivers were often merely commonplace persons. By the Middle Ages, premonition and prophecy had largely fallen into the realm of religion, especially so in Christian Europe, where they were often discussed through the lens of divine visions and discussions of biblical prophecy. For those foolish enough to depart from this accepted existence, persecution was often the outcome, as accusations of devilry and witchcraft were bandied about and thrown down upon anyone claiming anything that could have been construed as supernatural powers. The 16th century saw an increase in interest in the occult, and with it a new influx of seers and diviners, including characters like the infamous French astrologer Nostradamus, who published Le Prophète in 1555, by which time he had written down over 7,000 unique prophecies. Despite Nostradamus' prophecies relying heavily on earlier published classical works and a series of fairly robust and heavy rebuttals from many classical scholars over the years, there are still people today that believe that Nostradamus was able to predict many modern events, such as the Great Fire of London, the rise of the Third Reich, and the nuclear destruction of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Whilst it's likely that many of these modern events were interpreted retrospectively in modern times, with poor translations made to fit coincidental passages, his legacy as one of the most famous seers in history is still one of fantastic strength. In the late 17th and early 18th century, Martin Martin, a Scottish writer, was commissioned by the Royal Society to draft a full account on the geography, people, customs and cultures of the Western Highlands of Scotland. Born in 1660 and a graduate of Edinburgh University, Martin departed for the various islands stretching up alongside the coast of Western Scotland in 1697 and spent the next 6 years collecting the information for his book, which was essentially a travelogue of the Isles, finally published in 1703. Among the pages and pages of meticulous descriptions on life in the Outer Isles is a chapter based entirely on Martin's experience meeting diviners and seers, or those with the second sight, as he called it, who were able to predict anything from a sudden death to raging destructive fires. The chapter is particularly interesting in its lack of scepticism on the part of Martin, who had no qualms pulling apart tales of fairies, spirits and sprites earlier on in the book. On predicting death, he wrote, "When a shroud is perceived about one, it is a sure prognostic of death. The time is judged according to the height of it about the person. For if it is not seen above the middle, death is not to be expected for the space of a year, and perhaps some months longer. And as it is frequently seen to ascend higher towards the head, death is concluded to be at hand within a few days, if not hours, as daily experience confirms." Other signs seen in dreams were given explicit meanings, such as the sight of a woman standing on a man's left side, which would surely mean that the woman would become the man's wife, whether she was already married or not. Martin goes on to give several short accounts of seers that he had met or had heard stories of throughout his travels. One that lived in St. Marie's on the west side of the Isle of Skye told Mr. MacPherson, the minister, and others that he saw a vision of a corpse coming towards the church, not by the common road, but by a more rugged way, which rendered the thing incredible and occasioned his neighbours to call him a fool. But he bid them have patience, and they would see the truth of what he asserted in a short time. And it fell out accordingly, for one of the neighbourhood died, and his corpse was carried along the same unaccustomed way, the common road being at that time filled with a deep snow. This account was given to me by the minister and others living there. Another account tells of a woman whose vision led to her own death. There is another instance of a woman in Skye who frequently saw a vision representing a woman having a shroud about her up to her middle, but always appeared with her back towards her, and the habit in which she seemed to be dressed resembled her own. This was a mystery for some time until the woman tried an experiment to satisfy her curiosity, which was to dress herself contrary to the usual way. That is, she put that part of her clothes behind, which was always before, fancying that the vision at the next appearing would be the easier distinguished. And it fell out accordingly, for the vision, soon after, presented itself with its face and dress looking towards the woman, and it proved to resemble herself in all points, and she died in a little time after. By the late 19th century, the rise of spiritualism saw a new interest in the ability to see meanings and visions and interpret stories of the future, supposedly handed to mediums whilst communicating with the dead. The establishment of both the British and American Societies for Psychical Research saw investigations into the possibilities of precognition, given proper time and energy, and with the increased belief that science would unravel all the mysteries of the universe, as fantastic and unbelievable as they might at first seem, several writers published new philosophies on the existence of time itself. In 1927, British aeronautical engineer and philosopher John William Dunn published his book, An Experiment with Time, within which he describes a series of precognitive dreams and then goes on to lay out his theory of serialism, whereby he posits that humans exist in a multidimensional reality, and in our dreams, we're able to shift our consciousness to operate on one of a number of higher dimensions, allowing us to see time as a series, with the past and future able to be accessed freely. Amazingly, rather than questioning how much opium Dunn had been smoking, his theories were relatively well received, though over time, opinion has gradually shifted Dunn and his theory of serialism into the realms of speculative fiction, though his ideas are thought to have influenced writers like H.G. Wells, J.R.R. Tolkien, and C.S. Lewis. For a long time, in the 20th century, the concept of second sight, or precognition, was little more than an idea batted around in the fringe, esoteric societies, and riffed on in science fiction. But as it seems to have always been, so it continued, and the idea was always there, bubbling away in the public consciousness. Just as the idea of fortune-telling was beginning to become little more than a kitschy form of entertainment, a disaster in the south of Wales was about to act as the catalyst for one man to take everything a great deal more seriously, in an effort to save the world. The night of the 19th and 20th of October, 1966, was another wet, dreary one in a long line of wet, dreary nights in Wales that autumn. A young 10-year-old girl, Erylmy Jones, woke up after a restless sleep, where she had had a strange dream, and went downstairs to tell her mother all about it. "I dreamed I went to school," she said, "and there was no school there. Something black had come down all over." Erylmy's mother did what most mothers would. She reassured her daughter and then quickly dismissed it as nothing more than a bad dream. In truth, it wasn't the first time that Erylmy had acted a little strange that month. Earlier in October, she had told her mother that she was not afraid to die. This came completely out of the blue, and at the time, her mother had once again reassured her daughter that she was much too young to be thinking about her death. Erylmy lived in the small village of Abervan, in the south of Wales, situated in the Taff Valley, at the bottom of the western slope of Mynydd Merthyr Hill, founded on the site of a pair of rural and isolated cottages as a coal mining village after the nearby Merthyr Vale colliery had been opened in 1869. By 1966, Abervan had grown to a population of about 5,000 people, the vast majority who were employed to work in or around the mines. After more than 70 years of heavy industry, the mines had deposited over 2 million cubic metres of waste on a peak of the hill in seven towering conical piles of soil and loose rocks that had been dug out and carted up the hill by generations of coal miners from the village below. The most recently produced an only actively used pile, known to the workers as Tip No. 7, had been in service since 1958, and in the 8 years, it had grown to a height of 33 metres. On the morning of the 21st of October 1966, workers at the mine began arriving just as the sun was beginning to peak above the hills, looming over the valley. The heavy rain had been causing havoc with the hillside leading up to tip number 7 for the past 2 weeks, and as they were preparing work for the day, it didn't come as too much of a surprise to see that the entire heap had sunk at least 10 feet into the ground overnight. Di Jones, one of the slingers employed to cart the waste up to the tip, was sent to report the subsidence, and by the time he returned with the team leader, Leslie Davis, 2 hours later, the ground beneath the mound had sunk another 10 feet again. Clear that something would need to be done, work for the day was called off, and a site for a new heap was scheduled to be scouted out the following week. As Di Jones and Leslie Davis were making their way up to the tip, Errol Mai was making her way to Padglass Junior School, where lessons were due to start at 9 a.m. that morning. The school day had only just gotten underway, and the teachers were taking register when the sound, reminiscent of nearby thunder, rolled out across the valley. There was something unusual, however. There had been no accompanying flash of lightning, and the sound was seemingly growing louder. On the hillside, the grim truth was powering its way down into the valley, as 110,000 cubic metres of spoil tore down the slope at around 20 miles an hour in a wave that grew up to 30 feet tall. It would later be realised that tip number 7 had been built atop a spring, causing the ground to be compromised from the start. Following the weeks of rain, the whole tip had given way, causing a landslide that created enough energy to liquefy the saturated spoil, allowing it to flow down the hillside like a tidal wave. The first thing the wave hit were a pair of farming cottages that collapsed under the weight, their entire contents crushed by the force, including their occupants. When it reached the dismantled railway that bordered Abervan village, it smashed across and destroyed Padglass Junior School that sat on the boundary, along with a whole terrace row of houses, part of the secondary school opposite, and a second row of terrace houses deeper into the village, before eventually grinding to a halt as the whole weight of the tip crept out into the valley, leaving a black scar down the hillside and a trail of rubble in its wake. 109 of the 240 children attending school that morning were killed by the disaster, as well as 5 teachers. Outside of the school, another 7 children and 23 adults died, taking the death to 144. The disaster was national news, and the rescue efforts responded in kind to the gravity of the tragedy. Machinery and tools were repurposed from the nearby mines, floodlights were erected, and over 2,000 people joined the struggle, digging out much of the school by hand. Despite this Herculean effort of the locals, no survivors were found just an hour after the slide had come to a halt. In the weeks that followed, over £1.7 million was raised for disaster relief. The collections were so extensive, but they had little organisation, which led to the village quickly becoming saturated with donations. So much so that several counties actually had to enact a ban on any further fundraising in an attempt to bring the influx of items into the village, from over 12,000 toys to crates of tools, under control. Amongst the legions of rescuers, volunteers, journalists, photographers and TV personalities that descended upon the small village in the days after the landslide, a psychiatrist named John Barker arrived the very next day. Barker was a psychiatrist by trade, but in his time at the scene, he came to discover the influence of a much more interesting field that would go on to dictate his efforts for much of the rest of his life. Born in London in 1924, John Barker grew up in Blackheath. Like most children of his generation, his father had fought in the First World War, though when peacetime came, he left the forces and turned instead to accounting. John was an only child, though his home life was never quiet, as the family home consisted of not only himself and his parents, but of his aunt and uncle as well. He initially earned a scholarship to a boarding school in Kent, but shortly after the outbreak of World War II, his father re-enlisted and the whole family moved to Belfast. In Ireland, John studied medicine at Queen's University before moving back to Cambridge in 1943. By 1945, the war had ended and John had moved back to London, where he continued his studies, this time at St George's Hospital and Medical School. It was around this period of his life where John first began showing signs of a more than passing interest in the somewhat more fringe elements of science and psychology, when he started dabbling in the occult and casually investigating the psychical. Whilst in the learning hospital, he would speak endlessly to the nurses about their experiences with the ghostly apparitions that had long been rumoured to have stalked through the corridors. Their stories led him to the logical conclusion of attempting to contact the dead via a makeshift Ouija board, where he hoped he might be able to communicate with one of the school's old tutors, who, after dying at the school, had long been the source of many of the ghostly rumours. Following his graduation from medical school, Barker started his career in psychology, working within the asylum system. With a voracious appetite for discovery and research, Barker was keen on reforming the archaic system that had scarcely changed in decades, reflecting the bloated Victorian Gothic buildings that locked the patients within the system for years at a time, with little hope for a cure or even a release. Despite many of his reform strategies being fairly liberal and forward-thinking for the time, especially with his ideas about giving patients more freedoms and productive tasks to spend their time doing, some of his practices and cures are now viewed as just as archaic and cruel as the system he was fighting against in other areas. In particular, Barker had a special interest in aversion therapy, as well as an interest in the benefits of lobotomies. Outside of his office, he installed a slot machine that was wired up to give the player an electric shock rather than pay out on a win, which he hoped might one day cure gambling addictions. He also once claimed to have cured a married man of his extramarital affair by displaying alternating photos of the patient's wife and lover and then shocking his wrists with 70 volts of electricity every time the latter appeared. The whole process had apparently only taken 6 30-minute sessions, he said. Another of his fascinations was the possibility that one could be scared to death. Twice in his career, he believed that he had met patients who had been so convinced that they were going to die that they quite literally scared themselves to death. Barker worked for 8 years, climbing up through the ladder with avid enthusiasm, until he was given the position of Chief Medical Superintendent at Harrison Hospital, a large Gothic lunatic asylum in Dorset. As grand as the position was for him, it only lasted for a few months before he left, reportedly suffering from some kind of burnout or breakdown. In 1963, he transferred to Shelton Hospital in Shropshire, where he worked as one of 4 consultants. Whilst technically this was a demotion, the situation seemed a much better fit for Barker, who took up surfing, began eating better, lost a considerable amount of weight, and saw his own mental health flourish. By 1966, Barker's research into the possibilities of being frightened to death culminated in a book, which he planned to publish a year later, which was how he turned out to be in Abervan on the day after the coal mining disaster, mingling with the legions of volunteers and journalists who had all found their way to the small Welsh village. Amongst the many news reports on the disaster that saturated the press, Barker had come across the story of a young boy who had managed to survive the initial landslide, but later that day had died of shock, and he hoped that he might be able to track his family down. As soon as he arrived, however, it became apparent that the disaster had had such a profound impact and been so devastating that it was simply too soon for him to be asking around for such a story. Aside from the huge death toll, the poor weather had continued after the slide, and now people were concerned that the tip might slip again. On top of this, Barker was discovering that many of the locals were not exactly welcoming to outsiders looking to stick their nose into their business in order to profit from a catch or a scoop. In his initial investigations, Barker had come across another story anyway, one which interested him much, much more. By now, the story of Elmira Jones and her prophetic dream was beginning to spread, and when Barker heard the tale for himself, his ears pricked. After spending a little more time in Abervan, he returned home and contacted an acquaintance, Peter Fairley, the science editor for London's Evening Standard. Barker had always been an avid writer, and he'd frequently written letters to the various medical journals, often opening up debate about some of his more fringe ideas, including the ability for one to scare himself to death. It was these letters that brought him to the attention of Peter Fairley, and the two had communicated and collaborated several times since. Now, Barker approached Fairley with a new plan, and potentially his grandest yet. Spurred on by his earlier research of people being scared to death and of the story of Errol Mai, Barker wanted to open a proper study on premonitions and the people who believed that they had experienced them. Peter Fairley had been a household name in the world of science since 1961, when he had written a story suggesting that the Soviets were poised to send a man to space, and this was 2 days before Yuri Gagarin was launched out of the atmosphere. At the time, he had put his success down to little more than a hunch, but it had been much more than that. Fairley was an enthusiastic worker, absolutely convinced that science would one day solve all the world's problems. He had an open mind, and his finger was tightly on the pulse of the scientific community. The 60s would see him cover the space race incessantly, peaking with him presenting the British TV coverage of the American moon landing. Meanwhile, throughout the 60s, Fairley maintained a weekly column in the Evening Standard titled The World of Science, which consisted of stories that ran the gamut of believability from things so speculative that they neared science fiction to important international stories like the space race between America and the Soviets. John Barker contacted Peter Fairley upon his return from Aberfan because he quite expected that Fairley would be open to his ideas. And what's more, he knew that Fairley had just the platform that he needed. Barker proposed to the journalist that they collaborate on a national study, where they would send out an appeal asking for anyone who believed that they had a premonition to get in contact and allow them to gather as much detail as they could. Fairley, who had based his entire relatively expansive gambling career on the horses to what he liked to call his gut feelings, was naturally keen from the start. The following Friday, a week after the disaster, the Evening Standard carried the headline in its science pages: Did anyone have a premonition of the Aberfan disaster? In advance of most of the great disasters of history, such as the Titanic sinking, somebody seems to have had a premonition. Did anyone have a genuine premonition before the coal tip fell on Aberfan? The piece hinted at a psychologist who had contacted Fairley and asked for his help to uncover the potential psychics, though his name was kept out of the article, apparently on account of Barker wishing to remain anonymous. In its conclusion, it simply requested, "So, if anyone did have a premonition, would they kindly write?" And surprisingly, they did write. Following the initial appeal, Barker received a total of 76 replies from people all around the country. A 63-year-old man from the small village of Stackstads, north of Manchester, 200 miles from Aberfan, wrote to tell Barker about a dream that he had had 2 nights before the landslide, in which he was trying to buy a book in a Welsh village when he came across a large machine full of buttons that he thought was possibly a computer, though he admitted he had never seen one before. "Then, all of a sudden, while I was standing by this big machine, I looked up and saw Aberfan written as if suspended in a white lettering against a black background. This seemed to last some minutes. Then I turned and looked the other way, and I saw through a window rows of houses, and everything seemed derelict and desolate." It wasn't until the day of the disaster that the word Aberfan made any sense to him. Another reply came from a 47-year-old woman named Constance Milder from Plymouth, 150 miles south of Aberfan, who had seen a vision of an old schoolhouse the evening before the disaster whilst attending a meeting with her spiritualist circle. After the schoolhouse disappeared, she next saw what she described as an avalanche of coal. It wasn't until the day of the disaster, when she saw a young boy on the news that she believed she recognised, that she realised the vision had been prophetic. R.J. Wallington from Rochester in Kent wrote to Barker to tell him that he had felt for days before the disaster something terrible was going to happen. When he walked into work on Friday morning, just hours before the landslide, he apparently had told his secretary that today was going to be the day. When describing the feeling, he said it came on as strong as, "Might come the thought that you have forgotten that it was your wife's birthday tomorrow." Grace Richardson was a young woman from London who wrote to Barker with another different kind of premonition. She said that she could smell an earthy scent in the air for the week running up to the disaster that she described as the smell of death. At 9:45 a.m. on Friday morning, 15 minutes after the landslide, she jumped out of her seat at work, red-faced and breathing heavily, convinced that something terrible had happened. Of all the replies, Barker was most interested in respondents that described experiencing both physical and mental symptoms in their premonitions. There were 7 in total, including a 44-year-old continental telephone exchange operator from Dagenham in Essex named Alan Hencher and a 52-year-old music teacher named Kathleen Middleton from London. Alan Hencher had seemed especially unique in that he was sceptical of his own experiences and didn't seem to display any sense of superiority or really even any positivity towards his apparent gifts. He said that he had been involved in a car accident 18 years earlier, when he was aged 26, that had seen him lay in hospital unconscious for 4 days, and when he came round, he found that his visions began. Although he told Barker that he had accepted that he was able to foretell certain events, he said that he had no idea how or why. Kathleen Middleton was somewhat less sceptical about her premonitions. She believed that she had been the centre of unusual events since she was around 7 years old, when she had witnessed an egg frying in a pan levitate almost as high as the ceiling. At the age of 11, she had felt an urge to contact her piano teacher, she said. She nagged her parents until they agreed, only to find out that he had recently poisoned himself. It had been a pivotal moment in Kathleen's life. I could not rid myself of the thought that if I managed to contact him, he would have returned for supper and any problems could have been discussed, she later wrote in her self-published memoirs. On the morning of the Aberfan disaster, she woke at 6 a.m. with a terrible sense of foreboding that progressed her to physically choking as she felt the walls were closing in around her. Barker maintained contact with the respondents he felt most promise from and continued promoting his study, hoping to keep the respondents coming. In December of 1976, he was invited onto the Frost programme on the commercial British TV channel ITV, where he was hoping to show the nation that previous respondents were just ordinary people. He had invited Kathleen Middleton and Grace Richardson along with him. This was the first time that he was meeting the pair for himself too, and he later described them as different, though he did state that weirdos was too strong of a word. Whilst they waited for their interview backstage, the host of the programme, David Frost, made a stealth decision to bump the psychologist, most likely thinking that the subject of the Aberfan disaster was still a little too raw, and instead he allowed his first interview to overrun in order to brush off the waiting guests. This incident incited Barker, who felt that the host had not realised how important his study actually was. In the following weeks, he communicated with Peter Fairley, and the two agreed to step the whole thing up to the level that Barker believed it should have been on. No mere study, Barker wanted to set up an experiment that would log, track and record the premonitions' hits and misses in order to gain enough data that would allow him to take his idea to the government and lobby for some kind of official status. With Fairley's backing, the pair agreed to set up what would become the Premonitions Bureau, an idea that Barker believed could potentially be so profound that it might just be able to head off any disasters in future, before they had even happened, and he well believed that it had all the promise to be nothing else but the next leap forward for mankind. Fairley agreed to float the idea to Charles Winter, the editor of the Evening Standard, and when the pair were given the green light, they penned a new request to the nation, published on Wednesday the 4th of January, 1967. Donald Campbell apparently had a premonition of disaster the night before he died. Other people, apparently, had a premonition of the Aberfan tragedy. More than 75 replies were received in response to an Evening Standard appeal for authentic examples. After investigating these reports, a senior British psychiatrist believes that there is sufficient evidence to justify the setting up of a national early warning centre to analyse premonitions, detect common patterns in them, and sound the alarm if a particular disaster seems imminent. Such a centre might need a computer, an expensive piece of equipment, but if it did prove possible to harness premonitions so that loss of human life or damaged property could be avoided, the reward would be incalculable. We shall never know unless we try to find out. The article then proposed a new appeal. For the following 12 months, the paper would be accepting responses from the public that Fairley would then forward on to Barker. All submissions would then be tracked and checked against global events. In order to attempt to quantify everything, Barker had devised an 11-point system, whereby all submissions would be scored up to 5 points for accuracy, up to 5 points for unusualness, and a further point for timing. Fairley's department in the Evening Standard press room would become the site of the unofficial bureau. Fairley's assistant, Jennifer Preston, had the unfortunate job of sorting out each submission, and she devised 14 categories in which to place each one, including those that involved royalty, another for personalities, racing, fire, and non-specified disasters. As each submission came in, it fell to her to cross-check them with all the day's papers to see if they correlated with any of the breaking news. On the day after the piece in the Evening Standard, Fairley put his skill in self-promotion to use by taking part in a BBC radio interview where he once again put out a request for submissions, trying to cast his appeal as wide as possible. When the presenter asked him, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, if he expected many replies, Fairley countered, "Well, I have a horrible feeling that we should get a lot of letters and phone calls from cranks and highly imaginative people, but I don't want to put these people off necessarily, because a lot of imaginative people are sometimes thought to be people who genuinely have a gift of premonition." Despite the interviewer's scepticism, the Bureau found itself off to a racing start. Within 48 hours, the study had received 20 unique submissions, including one premonition of a train crash, two that involved a plane crash, and some that were frighteningly specific, including one that detailed a vision of a ceiling collapse in a department store named John Barker & Company in Kensington, London, which was, if nothing else, at least easy for Jennifer Preston to check. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given the spectacular nature of the study, Barker found his new research gaining a fair amount of popularity. In the weeks following the launch of the Premonitions Bureau, Barker had been writing openly to medical journals to discuss his theories around premonitions, convinced that the phenomenon was a genuine possibility and suggesting that the scientific community as a whole should be working towards working out how to utilise it for the good of mankind. Along with all the TV and radio interviews that Fairley was attending, it soon became apparent that John Barker was gaining attention that his bosses at the National Health Service absolutely did not want. Several articles reached the papers about his experiments with aversion therapy, and though some were neutral or inquisitive in their presentation, others were not so kind. By the spring of 1967, Barker was forced to approach his superiors and tell them all about his work with the Premonitions Bureau, as well as his plans to publish his study at the end of the year when he published his book on patients being scared to death. His superiors responded by telling him, in no uncertain circumstances, that he would have to publish any work on either subject, anonymously, or risk losing his job. Convinced that he was following a path that would lead him to something big, Barker ignored the warnings and decided to crack on regardless. His confidence wasn't entirely unfounded either. In April, the Premonitions Bureau had received their first major hit. At 6 a.m. on the morning of March the 21st, Barker had received a phone call from Alan Hentscher. Hentscher had just pulled a night shift at the telephone exchange, where he had come home to the conclusion that he needed to contact Barker urgently. He had received a premonition, he said, of a French passenger jet that had found itself in some kind of trouble as it flew over what he thought were mountains. The jet radioed that it was in trouble, but before any details were passed, the communication was cut off. The plane would have 123 or 124 people on board, and following the crash, there would only be a single survivor, though they would be left in poor condition. Obviously, this was a fairly tragic vision, and one that Barker would have dearly loved to have prevented from coming true. The details, however, were frustratingly vague. A month later, on April the 20th, a Britannia plane, flying for the Swiss company Globe Air from Bangkok to Basel, crashed in the mountains near Cyprus Airport after diverting off course due to bad weather. The accident saw 124 die outright, though a further two passengers who survived the initial crash died later. Although some of the details were slightly off, Barker was excited by the remarkable similarities in Hentscher's premonition and of the Globe Air plane crash. Unfortunately for him, just as he was gaining confidence in Hentscher's abilities, he received another phone call from the apparent seer, this time giving bad news on a more personal level. Barker had been trying to get in touch with Hentscher ever since the plane crash, and when Hentscher did finally pick up the phone, rather than sound happy, he spoke with a degree of nervous tension. Whenever he thought about Barker, he said, his mind filled with black. He said that he felt that there was an accident coming and asked Barker if he drove a dark car. When Barker responded that he did, Hentscher worryingly told him to be very careful. Barker, wanting to speak plainly, asked Hentscher if he believed his life was in danger. Yes, came the reply. It was a premonition that Barker took seriously. The very next day, he dictated a 4-page memo to his assistant on the details of the premonition. Although he played down his reaction, saying that he was only somewhat alarmed, his memo suggested he took it a little more seriously. I found it a little difficult to get off to sleep again, and have, of course, decided to take extra care while driving. It would be wrong for me to say that I was not frightened by a prediction of this nature. I intend keeping a diary from now on and to record my reactions to this on a daily basis. I suppose anybody who plays about with precognition in this way to some extent sticks his neck out and must accept what he gets. The important thing, though, is for this information to be recorded so that if anything does happen, it should cause some interest and may stimulate others to continue in this important work. Of course, it is possible that this prediction, as with the others, may not be fulfilled in a literal way. It would be curious, and remarkable indeed, if Mr. Hentscher could bring off a psychic hat trick. Having recently written a book on people who were scared to death, I am perhaps beginning to feel what this would be like. Meanwhile, whilst Hentscher had been keeping Barker busy, Kathleen Middleton had been having her own premonitions. In March, she had also contacted the Premonitions Bureau to inform them of a vision that she had had of her dead father sitting in her front room and speaking on the telephone to some unnamed caller about danger at sea. A few days after she had contacted the Bureau, an oil tanker named the Torrey Canyon ran aground on the Seven Stones Reef, 7 miles off the southwest coast of England, causing Britain's worst ever oil spill. Despite the details from Middleton being generally quite vague, Barker saw it as another major hit for the Bureau, and his confidence in her premonitions only grew when, a month later, Kathleen contacted the Bureau again, this time to predict a tornado or hurricane on the west coast of the United States. 11 days later, an outbreak of over 40 tornadoes hit the ground across 5 Midwestern states, causing havoc. Despite the fact that the actual outbreak had been thousands of miles from Kathleen's prediction, Barker decided that it had been a great success. Again, at the end of April, Kathleen wrote once more. This time, it was to warn the Bureau that an astronaut on his way to the moon would see his mission end in tragedy. In her letter, she wrote that she had seen an astronaut petrified, terrified, and just frightened. On the very same morning that Kathleen posted her letter, hours, in fact, after she had dropped it in the postbox, Soviet cosmonaut Vladimir Mikhailovich Komarov crashed into the Earth upon his re-entry to the Earth's atmosphere after his parachute failed to deploy. This time, Barker was absolutely ecstatic. "You were spot on," he wrote. "Well done." Whenever either of his prized subjects, whether Kathleen Middleton or Alan Hentscher, would contact the Bureau, Barker would always gee them on, cheer them for their successes, and encourage them to keep it up. He also sent Kathleen Middleton a copy of his 4-page memo concerning Hentscher's death premonition and asked her if she had also seen anything. Worryingly, she wrote back to Barker, telling him that although she had nothing specific, she had had some concerns. It was a reply that surely did absolutely no good for Barker's well-being. All the time his confidence grew in Hentscher and Middleton, his certainty that his own life was in danger only grew in correlation. What's more, Barker was beginning to find the whole study immensely frustrating, and the lack of details in many predictions, along with the difficult paradox that if they were able to prevent disasters, then the study subjects would have nothing to predict, all began playing on his mind. But still, the predictions kept coming. On May the 1st, Alan Hentscher called Barker once again, this time to warn him of another air disaster, this time causing more than 60 fatalities. The crash would happen within 3 weeks, he told Barker, though thankfully he saw there would be some miraculous survivors. 33 days later, a week and a half after Hentscher had predicted, a prop-driven British Midland plane crashed whilst flying over Stockport after 2 of the plane's 4 engines failed, likely due to the pilot mistaking the fuel levels. In October, Hentscher called the Bureau again, this time warning of a rail crash with many fatalities. Though there were barely any details, he did tell Barker that he had seen an image of 2 train cars derailed and lying on top of another. Kathleen Middleton also wrote to the Bureau a few weeks later on the 1st of November, telling them that while sitting in her kitchen feeling an overwhelming sense of depression, she had seen a bright flash of light followed by a grey mist. While she tried to focus on the location of the vision, she felt the words "train" coming through, and then people waiting in the station and the words "Charing Cross," the sound of a crash. 4 days later, on Sunday, November the 5th, the 1943 express train from Hastings to Charing Cross Station derailed after riding over a fractured rail, causing 4 of the 11 derailed cars to crash onto their sides, killing 49 passengers. This double hit delighted Barker, who even took part in an interview for the London Evening News, the Evening Standard's main rival. of his two-star subjects, he said, "Somehow, while dreaming or awake, they can gatecrash the time barrier. See the unleashed wheels of disaster turning before the rest of us. They are absolutely genuine. Quite honestly, it staggers me." It hadn't been just Kathleen Middleton and Alan Hentcher who had had major hits for the Bureau, however. In May, a woman named Lynn Singh from Thetford in Norfolk had written to the Bureau to describe a dream that she had had of what she called a tremendous conflagration taking place in a large building built with steel girders. As the building burned, she wrote of constant small explosions spurring the fire on. The same day, the Linnovation department store in Brussels caught fire, killing 251 people. As the giant store burned, the flames reached the camping department, causing explosion after explosion as the stock of gas tanks went up, one by one. 2 weeks later, the outbreak of the Six-Day War between Egypt and Israel had apparently been the subject of a premonition when a man named Michael Sangrove from King's Lynn had contacted the Bureau in early May to tell them of a dream that he had had, within which he had seen a great cargo ship stuck in the Suez Canal, a situation that came to pass on the outbreak of the fighting. By the end of the year, the Premonitions Bureau had received a total of 469 premonitions from people from all walks of life and all regions of the UK. Much to Barker's dismay, they had not managed to use a single one to avert a disaster of any scale. Worse, Hentcher had met Barker in London in January of 1968 and repeated his earlier warning to Barker, telling him in a frustratingly vague manner, "I think you're going to have some trouble." A brighter event should have been the publication of Barker's book, Scared to Death, on the 23rd of February, which, despite his superior's warnings, he published in his own name and included a detailed description of his work with the Premonitions Bureau. Unfortunately, as part of his promotional work for the book, he undertook an interview on the BBC Evening News, where Kathleen Middleton saw him and became overwhelmed with a black feeling that she wrote to tell him all about. Clearly the warnings were taking their toll, and Barker even began writing to Hentcher before he finalised any of his upcoming plans, asking if he felt he would be safe to travel on specific dates. Unsurprisingly, Barker's new book had seen mixed reviews, including many who were sceptical and found his theories controversial, which only helped to fill his promotional schedule, as newspapers, radios and televisions all scrambled to hear from the doctor himself. In his book, Barker had urged nations to filter their arms budgets into the research of premonitions, and even of time itself, a concept for which he posited some fairly out there theories. The real headline, however, came after a television appearance on the day after the book was published, when he told the host of the TV show that he was a guest on that he believed lives could have been saved in Aberfan if only the Premonitions Bureau had been operational, with a properly funded budget, at the time. The nearest the doctor has got to his ideal is the London Evening Standard's own Premonitions Bureau, which has been operating for about 12 months, and already several premonitions appear to have come to pass. Dr. Barker says, "We had a particularly good one about the Britannia air crash in Cyprus last April, and another one for the Hither Green train crash." For all the good that the explicit publicity might have had for Barker's new book, it had the very opposite effect for his superiors, at least until they had a bigger problem to deal with when 2 days later the women's wing of Barker's own hospital was burnt down, killing 24 of the patients inside. The irony of the situation, of course, not being lost on the press at the time. A month later, on the 11th and 12th of March, Peter Fairley wrote a special report for the Evening Standard, detailing the year-long operation of the Premonitions Bureau, stating that of all of their submissions, 18 had been what he called best buys, having scored more than 5 points on Barker's scale of 11 points. In the article, Fairley called in Alan Hentcher and Kathleen Middleton for an interview, and the pair met for the first time. He also included photographs of both, as well as descriptions from both on how they observed their premonitions. "I see a picture projected in front of my eyes," says Miss Middleton. "Usually, it's an object such as a vehicle or building. Sometimes I see words, such as plane or train, illuminated as though in neon. A day or two later comes the second stage. I try to concentrate, perhaps seeing the weather conditions at the time of the accident. This gives a clue to its likely location." In the case of Mr. Hentcher, the story is rather different. After some success in amateurish card-guessing experiments, he began to notice an ability to predict future events in 1953, 2 years after receiving a head wound in a car accident. Now he gets regularly a sharp pain, like migraine in my forehead, which lasts half a minute, followed by a dull feeling of pain at the back of my head where I had my accident. Reporting the premonition gets rid of the headache. Sometimes, he told me, I see things in black and white, sometimes in colour. I never get pleasant premonitions. The details seem to come almost as headlines, and they come afterwards. Mr. Hensher admitted to a definite feeling of fear when the headaches began. This can last up to 15 minutes, he explained. Then it disappears. In my mind, I hear or see the words, it has happened. The article also announced that the investigation and operation of the Premonitions Bureau would continue for another year. Unfortunately for Fairley and Barker, Alan Hensher and Kathleen Middleton continued to communicate after their meeting for the Evening Standard piece, and the results were not particularly good news for the Bureau. The piece, written by Fairley, had made it quite clear that Hensher and Middleton were the star responders to the Bureau's appeal, having made the vast majority of Fairley's best buys. And now, the two were conspiring to write their own book, independent from the study. Hensher, in particular, mentioned to Barker that he struggled both physically and mentally with his premonitions, and now he wanted a little something back for his troubles. To much of Barker's relief, the submissions, at least, continued to roll in. In April, Hensher called Barker, detailing a vision that he had of an air accident with a plane carrying 74 passengers. And on June the 4th, Kathleen called Barker several times, warning him that she believed Robert Kennedy, the leading Democratic candidate at the time, would soon be assassinated. The following night, he was fatally shot. It was another grim success for the Bureau. That summer, Barker took off around America on a speaking tour, promoting his book Scared to Death, as well as his work for the Premonitions Bureau. The tour prompted Robert Nelson, a member of the American Society for Psychical Research and prolific writer, to found the American branch of the Bureau, which he named the Central Premonitions Bureau. Shortly after his return to England, Barker was taken ill, suffering with exhaustion and headaches. The American tour had been a whirlwind of activity, given that he had to squeeze everything into a few short weeks that he had taken off from work, since his superiors had, unsurprisingly, denied him official leave to promote his book. Kathleen's final warning came on the 27th of July, when she wrote to Barker, telling him that she was now critically concerned for his health. She had seen, she told him, a vision of her deceased parents driving away in a black car, a scene which she now knew to be a portent for death, and she was sure it must mean that a friend would soon die. A month later, John Barker passed away in his home, aged 44 years old, following a burst blood vessel in his brain. An hour or two later, Kathleen woke in bed, choking from a deep sense of suffocation. Barker's death was reported on in the spiritualist newspaper, The Psychic News. Dr. John Barker, the consultant psychiatrist who believed the future would be foretold, died last week. Only 12 months ago, he circulated a private letter telling of a premonition of his own death and admitted that it worried him. Ironically, he was the author of a book dealing with the effects of such predictions called Scared to Death. Barker's sudden death obviously meant bad news for the Premonitions Bureau, which was further complicated by Fairley's departure from the Evening Standard after he had taken a job reporting on the Apollo moon missions for TV. The work was taken over by Fairley's assistant, Jennifer Preston, who had ultimately done much of the work anyway. She kept the Bureau running until deep into the 1970s, eventually collecting over 3,000 premonitions before it finally closed down. Of the 3,000, not a single one was ever used to avert disaster, and not a single early warning was ever issued. So that was the story of John Barker and his kind of kooky premonitions bureau. We'll talk a little bit about that after these short advert breaks. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you'd do if you had an extra hour in your day? Would you spend that extra hour in the gym, or maybe just take a nap, or read a book? A lot of us spend our lives wishing that we had more time. The question is, though, is time for what? If time was unlimited, how would you use it? The best way to squeeze that special thing into your schedule is to know what's important to you and what makes it a priority. Therapy can help you find what matters to you so that you can do more of it. Now, anyone that's listened to the show for a while will know that I've used BetterHelp for a little while and had positive experience of it. You know, I'm a big advocate of all forms of therapy. I do like talking therapy as well. BetterHelp is entirely online, and that's something that was obviously really important to me at the time, especially I was suffering from a bit of agoraphobia. So, you know, it was really important that it was online. And it's just so convenient. It's, you know, I basically attended on a Monday morning in my pajamas. It's flexible. It's suited to basically to fit your schedule. It's a far less intimidating situation than actually sort of going out, going to a office somewhere and, you know, meeting someone in person. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire. BetterHelp match you up with a licensed therapist. If you don't like that therapist, you can switch. I didn't need to, but apparently it's very easy and there's no additional charges. So yeah, if you're thinking about starting therapy, why not give BetterHelp a try? Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/darkhistories today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/darkhistories. Cheers. Welcome back. So yeah, this is a fascinating little story. One of the sort of interesting things about doing these cases that are a little bit later, like I say, like normally I don't tend to go past World War II, but doing these cases that sort of go into the 60s and 70s, one of the really interesting things is that British Pathé on their YouTube channel have got loads of reels from the Aberfan disaster. So it was incredible. I mean, I did sort of know of the Aberfan disaster anyway, but not well. But yeah, watching back through the old like black and white British Pathé YouTube channel reels of the disaster was, I mean, it was excellent to get context and stuff. But just to see the scale of the disaster as well, it was quite something. But it was really good to watch that. So yeah, I definitely recommend check out the British Pathé YouTube channel for the Aberfan disaster if you want to see a bit more about it. It's the literally like reporters there the day after, or possibly even the day of, but I would have thought it's the day after. Yeah, anyway, that was interesting. The story itself was really interesting. There's a couple of things that I would just a little talk about, but the interesting part of Barker's death obviously is the kind of the sort of big sort of interest, I guess, or one of the big interests in whether or not he died due to being scared to death. Like he, you know, he was writing that book all about being scared to death. And it seemed that by him learning from Hentscher and Middleton that they both believed that they'd had premonitions that he would die soon. Did that speed up his demise? You know, it's quite clear that he took the premonitions about his dying very seriously. When he writes about it, it's really interesting because he acts off the cuff slightly about it, but I think it's more his way, because when you read his writing, he's very like that about everything. Or he seemed to me like he tries to be very sort of flippant about everything, like, oh, you know, as if it's not too much of a big deal for him, which is clearly untrue, or was clearly untrue. So he died at quite a young age. There were signs, I guess. He was quite unhealthy for a few years. He lost a lot of weight when he started working at Shelton Hospital. But before that, he had been relatively unhealthy. But he was still only 44 years old, which is quite interesting. So yeah, there's that. And then there's the whole thing of whether or not you believe this to be true. You know, this is, I find them very fascinating, actually. I feel like when I was reading through the premonitions, it's, when you read just the hits by themselves, or what Barker presumed to be hits by themselves, I think you can look at it and go, oh, wow, like that's quite specific in some cases. And it seems like the only answer is that they must have had these dreams, right? But then you realize that this is like 3% of all of their submissions were actually, I hesitate to say, found to be true, but they correlated with news that actually happened. So that sort of diminishes it slightly, you know, and also shows that, you know, the Premonitions Bureau could never really have happened the way Barker initially envisaged it, because, you know, you'd be getting all these visions of things that just don't happen. If only 3% of them happen or less, then it's just no good. Unless they're incredibly specific, and then, you know, if it can prevent one, it would be great. But they just weren't. And that's what I think Barker found very difficult, was, you know, he found that the more, it was almost like the more he felt he was learning, the more frustrating it became, because the vague reality was just incredibly sort of frustrating. He felt, never felt like he was getting closer to any sort of functional bureau. But I think Premonitions remind me a little of like good old fashioned conspiracy theories, like the moon landings or something like that, where, you know, they're good fun to read about, and you can entertain them if you just read the evidence for it, you know, written by someone who believes it. You know, you probably come out the other side of that thinking like, yeah, I reckon you might be right. You know, I reckon people might not have landed on the moon. And then, of course, that is precisely what makes a good conspiracy theory, because when you then go and scratch at the surface and look at the evidence, it all falls apart very quickly. But the story is, you know, like the surface story is very good. It captures a lot of what look like coincidences and things like that to sort of use them as quote unquote evidence. And so it looks like a really, you know, a good story. And that, I think, is what happens with these premonitions a lot. You know, they look like good stories when you put them next to, like, for example, the plane crash that Hentscher predicted. And then you put it next to the plane crash and you think, wow, look, you know, he was only a week and a half off, and he guessed 124 people and 126 people died. Like, wow, that's close. But actually, is it? You know, like, I there are things you can check to really check that. Like, how many people did the average passenger plane carry in those days? You know, was it around about 124? If it is, then that's probably how he got to that number as well, you know. But still, there's just enough there, isn't there? Like, and that's what makes them great, you know. That's what makes them interesting, is there's just enough there to sort of tease you and think, yeah, but maybe. So, like, the train crash one I thought was interesting, where, you know, they both predicted a train accident. I think it was Kathleen Middleton, that actually predicted, saw the sign saying Charing Cross, which, of all the train stations in the country, there's a lot of train stations in England and, you know, across Britain, and she sort of pulled that one out of the hat. It's, of course, it's one of the main ones. You know, if she'd have said Victoria or Paddington or, you know, any of those large train stations, you might, you know, Clapham Junction or whatever, you might think, yeah, okay, she's just pulling a random train station out of a hat. But still, you know, she did get it right. So it does make you wonder. I think I'm inclined to believe her more than Alan Hentscher, if anything. I think Alan Hentscher, a few of his were just too vague, whereas Kathleen Middleton did seem to supply a few more details. But I don't know if I believe either of them. But it's fascinating, and I have to admit, I don't want to say I believe it, because I don't really have any evidence to back it up. But they're convincing stories, I'll say that much. You know, I feel like sometimes they can be quite convincing stories. Of course, there are lots of things you can look at and go deeper and write them off. Of course you can. But on the surface, they're really good stories that are fairly convincing, I think. Whether or not that, you know, you take that a step further and say that you believe them to be true is, you know, entirely up to you, I guess. I'm not really sure I'm that comfortable going that far, but yeah, it's a great story. And I think Barker was an interesting guy coming up with the Bureau. I think it was, it's quite an out there thing to have come up with, but fair play for him to, you know, give it a fair crack. So yeah, thanks very much for listening. I'll leave it there for today. If you'd like to contact me, you can do so. The email address is contact@darkhistories.com. You can also get in touch via social media. I'm on just about all sorts of social media. There is a website, darkhistories.com, and all the ways of contacting me, including a contact form for the email, it's there, as well as in the show notes. If you would like to support, there is a Patreon. Again, links to that on the website or in the show notes. Otherwise, thanks very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the story this week, and I'll be back in a couple of weeks with another one for you. Until then, take care. Sleep tight.